Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Israel and Hamas may be guilty of war crimes, and experts reach the Ukrainian crash site. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. United Nations officials say they are outraged after an apparent Israeli shell slammed into a UN school in Gaza, being used as a shelter from violence. 15 people were killed, including children and UN staffers. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he is appalled. UN officials cannot yet verify if it was an Israeli shell that hit the school, but they say Israel had been given the precise coordinates of the location of the building. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, says the targeting of civilian infrastructure or the use of civilian structures for military purposes violate international humanitarian law and international human rights law. She warns both Israel and Hamas may be guilty of war crimes in breaching these humanitarian principles. Lisa Schlein reports.
The UN's top human rights official, Navi Pillay, says homes, hospitals, UN schools, and life-sustaining infrastructure, such as the power station, water, and sewage services in Gaza, are protected under international law. She says attacks against objects which are being used exclusively for humanitarian assistance may amount to a war crime. She notes 250,000 Palestinians now are sheltering in schools run by UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency. She calls the shelling by Israel of these schools and the killing and wounding of civilians sheltering there as unconscionable. She also condemns Hamas's use of UN premises as a repository for weapons, calling this a flagrant violation of the neutrality of UN premises. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An international team of experts has reached the crash site of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in eastern Ukraine for the first time after days of attempts foiled by violence in the area. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe announced the development today, saying a small team of monitors accompanied by four Dutch and Australian experts had reached the site using a new route. Argentina has defaulted on its debt for the second time in 13 years. Argentinian negotiators failed late Wednesday to reach agreement with New York investment companies to avert the default. The hedge funds are demanding full payment of $1.5 billion on discounted Argentinian bonds they bought the last time the South American nation defaulted in 2001. Meanwhile, the Argentine president, Cristina Kirchner, is calling the holdout investment creditors vultures. Vietnam said today that its foreign policy is aimed at protecting the country's independence. The comment follows a letter from prominent members of the Communist Party to the country's top leaders calling for political and economic reforms and the country's reliance on China. Marianne Brown reports.
Vietnam's Ministry of Foreign Affairs on Thursday defended Hanoi's foreign policy following a question related to an open letter from prominent members of the Communist Party that urged the country to end its close relationship with China. Speaking at a regular press briefing in the capital, spokesman Lê Hải Bình said Vietnam's current policy aims to protect the independence, reliance and diversification of international relations. He said the implementation of Vietnam's foreign policy has greatly contributed to heightening the position of Vietnam on the global stage, as well as contributing to the development and depiction of the country. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Rescue workers in western India are digging through the mud in a search for survivors of a landslide that has killed at least 21 people. Officials fear more than 100 people are missing after the landslide on Wednesday flattened Malin village, which is 60 kilometers from the city of Pune in Maharashtra state. The death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has climbed to 729, including 50 more new fatalities reported since last Friday. The latest update from the World Health Organization came as officials in Sierra Leone and Liberia moved to enact intensive new measures to stop the Ebola virus from spreading. Sierra Leone's president said the government will quarantine areas where the disease is found. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Sierra Leone and Liberia are implementing dramatic new measures to try to contain a regional Ebola outbreak that has already killed hundreds.
That's VOA West Africa correspondent Anne Look reporting. Details coming up. Also in the news, in Libya, hardline Islamic militias claim to be in control of Benghazi. And northern Nigeria has seen its fourth female suicide bombing in a week with an attack that killed six people. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, in Libya, hardline Islamic militias claim to be in control of Benghazi, the country's second largest city. The Associated Press reports the militias claim to have defeated army units there. They also say they have seized tanks and hundreds of boxes of ammunition. The militias have been fighting forces led by a renegade general, Khalifa Haftar. He had vowed to defeat extremist militias. Meanwhile, heavy shelling is reported in southern Tripoli. Reuters reports rival militias are battling for control of the main airport. There's also word today that Tunisia may close its border with Libya. That's because of the heavy influx of Libyan refugees. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry says up to 6,000 people a day are crossing the border. Sierra Leone and Liberia are implementing dramatic new measures to try to contain a regional Ebola outbreak that has already killed hundreds. The president of Sierra Leone has declared a national emergency and quarantined affected regions. Liberia is considering doing the same. VOA West Africa correspondent Anne Look has more.
This is the worst outbreak of Ebola since the disease was discovered in 1976. But the strategy for fighting it is the same, containment. That means isolating the sick and monitoring those who have had contact with a sick person. Ebola spread into Sierra Leone and Liberia from Guinea in April. Health experts say it's unlikely the outbreak will move beyond West Africa. But further cross-border contagion within the region is still a concern. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf announced new measures to combat what she said is the rapid spread of the disease in Liberia.
Without exception, all schools are ordered closed pending further directive from the Ministry of Education. Several communities are being considered to be quarantined based upon recommendations from the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare and other relevant authorities. When these measures are instituted, only healthcare workers will be permitted to move in and out of those areas.
She put all non-essential government employees on a 30-day mandatory leave and has restricted travel for government officials. Ebola has killed more than 700 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone since March. It has reached the densely populated capitals of all three countries. In Sierra Leone, President Ernest Bai Koroma says he is deploying security forces to quarantine what he called the epicenters of the disease in the east of that country. Police will enforce the screening of everyone going in or out. He said trained volunteers will be tracking down people who have been exposed. In his address to the nation, Mr. Koroma insisted, Ebola is real. Ebola kills. Health workers have met resistance from communities in Sierra Leone and the two other affected countries. Fear, mistrust, and superstition have made it difficult and even at times dangerous for health workers to work. Meanwhile, the disease has spread to new communities. Liberia and Sierra Leone have ordered police to protect health workers and facilities following attacks and incidents of sick people being forcibly removed from clinics. In both countries, it's already against the law to harbor someone suspected of having Ebola. Two of the main airlines servicing the region, Askai and Eric, have canceled flights in and out of Freetown and Monrovia, after an infected Liberian man traveled by plane to Lagos last week and died there of the disease. That incident put the international community on high alert, but the World Health Organization says the risk to travelers is low. Ebola is spread through close contact with an infected person's bodily fluids once early symptoms like fever and vomiting appear. Family members and those caring for the sick, as well as people washing and burying the bodies of the dead, are at the highest risk. There is no cure for the virus, but available statistics show that just over a third of those infected during this outbreak have been able to fight off the infection with proper medical care. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
An NGO says containing the West Africa Ebola epidemic will require overcoming fear and stigma surrounding the disease. ActionAid says the high death rate has caused a lack of faith in the medical system. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports on the group's efforts to help contain the outbreak in Sierra Leone.
The World Health Organization says there have been more than 470 confirmed cases of Ebola in Sierra Leone. There are several hundred more suspected cases. More than 230 people have died. ActionAid country director Mohamed Sila says the major challenge facing Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia is a poor health infrastructure. He says the countries are simply not well equipped to handle the crisis because of a lack of investment in health. Sila says those countries need to act to change that.
First, it has to do with necessary training for the staff, equipping the staff with the basic equipment that they need to actually carry out their work. Issues as simple as an ambulance is a challenge for major hospitals if you have a suspected case. There are very limited ambulances around to collect the sick people and easily isolate them.
He says many community health centers lack access to electricity. That means no refrigeration to safely store vaccines or drugs that are susceptible to heat. Another major problem is fear, and fear of Ebola is widespread among the population. The ActionAid country director says many people actually deny the existence of the disease and attribute the sickness and death to some other cause. Also, the message that was sent out after the Ebola outbreak was confirmed was that it had no cure. When families did bring their sick relatives to the hospital, patients were immediately placed in quarantine, and the family lost contact with them.
That lack of communication, that lack of clarity, brought about the mistrust. People saw the hospitals now as a death zone. What happened in the isolation centers was not very, very clear to the general public.
There have been several incidents in Sierra Leone where families removed infected people from hospitals. Those incidents, Sila says, not only indicate the lack of information families had about the disease, but the lack of security at the health facilities. But what message can be sent when a disease is so often fatal? Sila says it has to do with educating the communities. ActionAid staff and others are going door to door in Sierra Leone doing just that, explaining prevention methods, signs and symptoms, and the importance of taking people to the hospital.
Because we have a long-term presence in the communities, they trust us. They trust the information that we give them.
Local and traditional leaders play a big role in those education efforts. Sila also says there's a lack of testing centers. For example, there are just two in eastern Sierra Leone. One is run by the Ministry of Health and the other by Doctors Without Borders. Some people may have to travel hundreds of kilometers to reach them and then wait 2 or 3 days for the results. It was during that waiting period that families removed patients from health facilities. One thing being done to raise hope among the population is to talk about the people who became infected and survived. ActionAid, the Ministry of Health, and many volunteers are sending the message that medical care gives people a chance of overcoming the disease. And they point to the nearly 130 infected people who have so far. And those survivors are now helping to educate the population through media campaigns.
We are gaining confidence of the people. And what you can even see from the government figures is that the number of people who are reporting to the health center is actually increasing.
Sila is calling for greater international support for Sierra Leone to increase the number of Ebola rapid testing centers. He says this would go a long way toward controlling the outbreak. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The largest known outbreak of the lethal Ebola virus in West Africa is prompting authorities as far away as Asia to take preventative measures, although scientists say a global spread of the disease is not likely. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
At South Korea's Incheon International Airport, a major hub for air travel in Asia, quarantine inspections of arriving passengers are being enhanced. Authorities say all passengers are being recorded by an infrared camera to detect fevers. South Korea's foreign ministry spokesperson Han Hye-jin says this is being done because Ebola is becoming a big concern. She says the South Korean government, in association with health authorities, is paying attention and carefully determining if additional measures are needed. The country's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it established an Ebola task force in April and is prepared for possible infections in South Korea. It is also urging South Koreans not to visit the affected African countries. Australia is also cautioning against travel to Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Australia's chief medical officer, Chris Bagley, says the possibility of Ebola arriving there is very low, but all border protection agencies are on alert for possible symptoms in people arriving by air or sea. Dr. Nicholas Day, director of the Mahidol Oxford Tropical Medicine Research Unit in Bangkok, says these enhanced port screenings implemented in Asia during previous swine and bird flu scares are no panacea.
It hasn't really, to my knowledge, been conclusively proven that it's an effective public health measure. It makes people feel happier that something's being done. But remember that people with flu, for example, don't have to be symptomatic when they come through. If you're screening using an infrared camera for temperature detection, it doesn't necessarily pick up people who are infected. The same is true for Ebola.
The incubation period of the Ebola virus is between 2 and 21 days, during which time an infected person might not show any signs of infection. In Hong Kong, the Center for Health Protection says public hospitals will begin to report and test all those who developed fever who, within the past 21 days, traveled to the three affected African countries. Although there are no direct flights from West Africa to Hong Kong, the city's health minister, Dr. Ko Wing Man, expresses concern that infections could still enter the region via a plane flight. Hong Kong's health minister issued the warning following an emergency meeting held with specialists to discuss contingency plans should there be an outbreak there, some 13,000 kilometers from West Africa. Ko says suspected cases will be put into isolation as soon as they are identified. Suvarnabhumi, just outside Bangkok, is one of the world's busiest airports, with more than 30 million passengers passing through every year. Thai officials say only 30 to 50 persons per week are believed to come from the countries with the current Ebola outbreak. So far, no special screenings for Ebola among incoming passengers are being implemented, but all hospitals in Thailand are being ordered to monitor patients for any related symptoms, particularly those who have traveled to the outbreak area. Some airlines have suspended flights into the affected region, but health authorities say there is little risk of passengers contracting the virus on a flight from an infected person. Dr. Day, a tropical medicine researcher, explains Ebola is only spread through direct contact with blood, saliva, and other bodily fluids.
The reason why everyone's scared about this, and I think quite reasonably so, is that this is a particularly horrible disease. It's quite, luckily, quite difficult to transmit unless you're in actual physical contact with a patient. So with standard public health and clinical isolation quarantine measures, it should be possible to contain any outbreak.
Since March, there have been more than 1,200 confirmed Ebola cases in West Africa. This is believed to be a new strain of the virus, and nearly 700 of those infected in this worst-known outbreak have died. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Nineteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Northern Nigeria has seen its fourth female suicide bombing in a week, with an attack that killed six people and injured at least seven others at a college yesterday. In a separate incident, a 10-year-old girl was arrested wearing a suicide belt. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja on this alarming new trend.
Students in the northern city of Kano were reading the National Youth Service notice board, looking to see what post-graduation public service job they would be assigned to, when a girl in their presence blew herself up. Police spokesman Frank Mamba says Boko Haram insurgents are now recruiting women and girls for attacks.
They take advantage of the fact that women raise fewer suspicion to try to indoctrinate and recruit female suicide bombers.
After the fourth suicide bombing by a female in as many days, authorities also arrested two girls, an 18-year-old and a 10-year-old, who was wearing a bomb belt in Katsina State. Some analysts fear the bombers are not recruits, but some of the hundreds of women and girls Boko Haram has kidnapped this year, including more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped from the town of Chibok in April. Activists with Bring Back Our Girls, a group demanding the rescue of the schoolgirls, say as far as they're concerned, the only thing the government should be doing is finding the girls. This is Hafsat Baba, an organizer with Bring Back Our Girls.
The children are our children, and we'll continue to fight, and we'll continue to tell the government, we'll continue to talk about it until these children are rescued alive and within the shortest time period.
After more than 100 days of captivity, the girls must be suffering unimaginable trauma, she says. Kanu and Katsina are both in the north, but they are not among the three Nigerian states that have been under emergency rule for more than a year. Last month, police said a female suicide bomber struck in Lagos, Nigeria's financial capital, and far from the war zone. She was the only person killed. Jibrin Ibrahim, the executive director of the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja, says the insurgency, which has left thousands of people dead this year alone, is growing in both its reach and its capacity for violence.
The evidence is quite clear that the insurgency is getting worse, and the capacity of the state to stop the insurgency appears to be declining.
Moses Ochonu is an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University in the United States. He, like many other analysts, says Nigeria needs outside help from the U.S. and other countries if it hopes to stop the militants.
I think the United States can play the role of putting pressure on the Nigerian government, causing them to do more, but also working with international partners as well to help the Nigerian government to actually optimize its effort in this fight against Boko Haram.
He says it's not just Nigeria's military that needs help, but all of northern Nigeria, where jobs and education are in short supply. Boko Haram, he says, recruits undereducated young people with no jobs and who feel that neither their government nor any other government cares for them at all. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Poachers make millions of dollars each year by the illegal killing of endangered African wildlife. They sell elephant or rhino tusks around the world as trophies. But the U.S. government is taking action. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it recently confirmed the suspension of imported trophies of elephants killed in Zimbabwe on or after April 4, 2014. The suspension comes after a review of Zimbabwe to verify whether Harare was complying with the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Tim Van Norman is the chief of branch of permits for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the findings of the study which led to Zimbabwe's suspension.
We were looking at whether the hunting of elephants as sport trophies provided a benefit or enhanced the species in the wild. This is coming under the requirements of the Endangered Species Act that says that the import of trophy elephants has to provide that benefit or enhancement. And so we were looking for that, particularly within Zimbabwe. Is the hunting program in Zimbabwe, U.S. hunters going to Zimbabwe, are they providing for the benefit to the species?
And did you find that they were?
We did not. We made a finding on July 17th that basically stated that there was not sufficient information from Zimbabwe to determine that the activities going on there were benefiting the species.
What type of activities were taking place?
Well, what we were looking for as far as trying to determine enhancement was to find out if the hunting programs were well managed on a scientific basis. Was revenue that was coming in from U.S. hunters being utilized in a manner that further benefited the elephant, either through, you know, developing management programs, anti-poaching activities, addressing human-elephant conflicts? You know, U.S. hunters spend quite a bit of money when they go hunting. Much of that goes back into the economy. Some portion of that is also going to the government or to regional government officials or authorities. And so what we were trying to find out is, was that money being utilized in a manner that provided benefit to the elephants? And we didn't have documentation or evidence to say that it did. Conversely, we didn't have anything that saying that it wasn't, but our finding has to say that there is a benefit, not just a zero-sum game.
As a result, then, there was a suspension of the import of elephant trophies for Zimbabwe. What is the next step, then? What takes place after this?
We have sent a letter to Zimbabwe. We're hoping that we can work with them to identify where there's information gaps. The hope is that the information is there, that they're doing these activities. It just was not relayed to us when we communicated with them earlier in April. We established an interim suspension in the hope of getting information. We received a lot of information from Zimbabwe, as well as from NGOs and interested parties. And based on that information, we made our decision on July 17th that basically, of the information that was available, it was not enough to support making an enhancement finding.
Also, in your press release, you pointed out that you're going to be reevaluating Zimbabwe in December of this year.
We certainly will. If we don't get more information between now and then, we do want to look at what's happening in Zimbabwe so that we can make a decision for the coming year. The current suspension only applies for 2014. We need to make a new finding for 2015. The hope is that in November, December, we can get enough information to lift the suspension. But it will depend on what happens in Zimbabwe and what information is provided to us.
Is there concern of the elephant population dwindling in Zimbabwe?
No, it's certainly not dwindling. The problem is, and stated in our finding, is that there hasn't been any recent countrywide surveys of elephant populations. There is currently right now an effort to do I believe it's called the Pan-African Aerial Elephant Survey, which would look at the elephant populations across much of southern and eastern Africa. The hope would be that with that survey, we get a very good idea of the population numbers within Zimbabwe. It would also give an indication of the mortality rate. How many animals are dying? Is it above or below normal mortality rates? You would expect a certain number of elephants to die of old age or other activities, disease. Does the counting the carcasses that they'll do during this aerial survey, does it indicate that there's poaching? So that information would be very important. Right now, Zimbabwe says that they have approximately 100,000 elephants. We'd like to get information to show that that is accurate, or is it overestimated, underestimated, and what's the level of poaching that's going on.
That was Tim Van Norman, Chief of Branch of Permits for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Falls Church, Virginia. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Mouhi in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Libya, hardline Islamic militias claim to be in control of Benghazi. Sierra Leone and Liberia are implementing dramatic new measures to try to contain a regional Ebola outbreak. And northern Nigeria has seen its fourth female suicide bombing in a week with an attack that killed six people. Coming up, we have music from the DRC, and in our feature segment, an administrative initiative to help cultivate Africa's next generation of political, social, and economic leaders. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots and lots of Africa football news for us this evening.
Lots on the plate this evening, Kim. Joining us once again on the Voice of America from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening from Washington, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, African football fans looking forward to another big weekend of qualifying matches for next year's African Nations Cup tournament in Morocco. Can you run down the fixtures for us?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. On Saturday, we've got five matches, and on Sunday, we've got two. Let's look at those Saturday matches first. In Blantyre, it's Malawi against Benin. Now, Benin are leading 1-0 from the first leg, a goal from Cesc Nong. No surprise about that scorer. He's got four of the five goals Benin have scored in this competition so far, and he is clearly the danger man. He plays for West Bromwich Albion in the English Premier League. In Victoria, it's the Seychelles against Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone leading 2-0 from the first leg. Now, Sonny, as lopsided fixtures go, it's hard to beat this one. If we look at Sierra Leone's world ranking, it's 64, and the Seychelles 182. And I swear by my mathematics on this one, that is a difference of 118 places. So I think I'm not being particularly brave when I say that Sierra Leone must be favorites to advance from this tie. In Kigali, we've got Rwanda against Congo-Brazzaville. Congo-Brazzaville 2-0 up from the first leg. Now, what Rwanda's coach, Stephen Constantine, will be hoping for is a repeat of the previous round when, at home, Rwanda shattered the hopes of Libya with a very impressive 3-0 victory off a hat-trick from Bo Weary. The Rwandans, if they can win this return match by three goals, will advance into the group stage of the competition where South Africa, Nigeria and Sudan would await them. In Bissau, it's Guinea-Bissau against Botswana, and Botswana are yet another team with a 2-0 lead. However, the Botswana preparations were thrown into jeopardy almost earlier this week when they discovered we have a trip to West Africa, but we have no money for the flights. And the Botswana government, to their credit, came in as last-minute providers of the cash. So I can confirm that that match is definitely going to go ahead. And this is an intriguing one, Sonny. Botswana made it difficult for the Guinea-Bissau team ahead of the first match. For whatever reason, six of the Guinea-Bissau players were not permitted entry into Botswana. The claim was there were visa problems. And as soon as the final whistle went in the first leg, the Guinea-Bissau officials and the coach said, "Watch out, Botswana, in the return match." And, Sonny, that's the way it works quite often in African football. People have got good, long memories. And I've got a strong suspicion that in this return match that Botswana are not going to get any particular favours when they arrive in Guinea-Bissau. So although the Botswana team have got a two-goal lead, I think this is one where things could end up maybe going in the direction of Guinea-Bissau. In Nouakchott, Uganda take a 2-0 lead against Mauritania, and that should be enough to see them through. Uganda, of course, as we've mentioned several times now on the sunny side of sport, I suspect our Ugandan listeners are getting tired of me coming up with this statistic, but the last time the Ugandan Cranes competed at the Africa Cup of Nations was way back in 1978. That's an awful long time ago. I promise I won't mention that statistic, Sonny, for at least another week. On to Sunday, two interesting matches. Now, you'll notice from my first leg scores that the home teams are all winning and they're not conceding any goals. But there was one exception to that, and that was the match between Tanzania and Mozambique in Dar es Salaam. That finished 2-2, which means that Mozambique, in five matches against Tanzania, have never lost in the Africa Cup of Nations. And obviously, as a result of that, Sonny, the Mozambican Mambas, as they're known, which translated means the snakes, they must be favourites for the return match, remembering that either 0-0 or 1-1 would give the tie to the Mozambicans on away goals. A 2-2 tie would mean a penalty shootout and a higher draw, in other words, 3-3 or 4-4, and the Tanzanians would go through. An interesting aside to this match is that Mart Nooy, the Dutch coach of Tanzania, coached Mozambique for 4 years, and he's still very confident. He told the Sunnyside of Sport that this battle is far from over, that he's got great confidence in his side. They scored two goals away to Zimbabwe in the previous round. So all in all, Sonny, a really interesting battle looming in four of the five previous matches between these two countries in the Cup of Nations. They have ended in draws, so I think it's going to be pretty tight. But nevertheless, Mozambique must start as slight favourites. And then another humdinger in prospect in Nairobi in Kenya, between Kenya and Lesotho. The Lesotho Crocodiles, as they're known, leading 1-0 from the first leg. Now, Kenya, it's back to 2004 when they last competed at the Cup of Nations. So they're another East African team, very keen to get back into the mainstream of African football. And an interesting statistic, Sonny, about Lesotho. They have lost their last 11 away matches in the Cup of Nations. And even more worrying for the Crocodiles is that in 10 of those 11 defeats, they failed to score. And in the other one, they only scored one goal. And that's a shambolic away record. 11 defeats in a row and one goal scored. And on that basis alone, Kenya must have a good chance of scraping through. Voice of America! A reminder, Sonny, to all Voice of America listeners that these are the final qualifying fixtures for the group stage. So after these seven matches this weekend, five on Saturday and two on Sunday, we will then have 28 survivors, and they'll be split into seven groups of four. The draw's already been made, and obviously on the forthcoming Sunnyside of Sport, we will give that full draw again. And of those groups, Sonny, the top two sides, the team finishing first and second, they automatically go to the finals in Morocco, who also qualify automatically. And that would leave us with just one place, and that place will go to the best third-place team among the seven groups. So exciting times. The matches themselves, we have two in September, two rounds in October, and another two rounds in November. Also in November will be the draw for the finals. And then the tournament itself, the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, starts in mid-January and ends in early February.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In more African football news, Ivory Coast has hired Frenchman Herve Renard as its head coach. The 45-year-old Renard led Zambia to the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations title in Gabon. Ironically, he now is in charge of the team he defeated in the Nations Cup final in Libreville. In a dramatic penalty kick shootout, the Chipolopolo of Zambia edged the Elephants of Ivory Coast 8-7 in the 2012 Nations Cup final after the teams played to a scoreless draw after 120 minutes of football. Renard replaces another Frenchman, Sabri Lamouchi, who left after Ivory Coast was eliminated in the group stage at the recent World Cup in Brazil. Renard returns to international coaching after a nine-month stint with the French club Sochaux. He also coached Angola briefly in 2010. During his playing career, which lasted from 1983 to 1998, Renard was a defender for three French clubs. Herve Renard is now charged with leading Ivory Coast to a berth at next year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Morocco. Ivory Coast won its only Nations Cup title in 1992 when the competition was hosted by Senegal. The Nigeria Football Federation is reportedly close to a new contract agreement with Stephen Keshi to return as head coach of the national team, the Super Eagles. Keshi led the Super Eagles to the round of 16 at the recent World Cup in Brazil, the first African coach to take a team to that stage at football's premier event. Reports from Nigeria say there are still a few details to be ironed out in a new contract, but Keshi would receive a raise of more than $12,000 a month to more than $43,000 a month. During Keshi's first contract, he complained of not being paid by the federation for long periods of time. And I know our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, is closely following the Keshi story.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled 8 World Cups, and I write about a new book by George Vesey, longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. In the book, the 75-year-old Vesey reflects on some of his experiences covering the 8 World Cup football tournaments before Brazil 2014. One of the funnier chapters is titled Marking Maradona, and George reminisces about trying to track down the great Argentine footballer for an interview. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, an administrative initiative to help cultivate Africa's next generation of political, social, and economic leaders. And next, an accord to enlarge market reach and earnings for African products. But first, some music. Here is Johnny Bash of the DRC with Ania Kulokulo.
kulokola
Yesu
ani ya kulokola
Yesu
ani ya kulokola
Bash of the DRC with Ania Kulokulo.
Well, this week, President Barack Obama meets with hundreds of young African Leadership Initiative fellows. They're part of an administrative initiative to help cultivate Africa's next generation of political, social, and economic leaders. They've spent the past several weeks at U.S. universities studying business and entrepreneurship, civic leadership, and public management. One such fellow is Fatoumata Sylla of the Seychelles, an island country of about 190,000 people. She currently serves as Director General in the Executive Office of her country's president. She has worked as the Director General of Youth Affairs, helping to influence government policy toward young people, including youth programs. Fatoumata says following her fellowship in Washington, she plans to create a mentorship project for youth and by youth. Fatoumata tells us more about her career, goals, and her stay in the U.S.
My name is Fatoumata Sylla. My country has recognized me as a potential leader as I have been active in different spheres, in different fields in Seychelles. I've worked for the past 3 years with the youth department, and I have been able to help cement some youth programs, especially on entrepreneurship and also on the international scene, where I have been able, with the help, of course, of other people, of young people themselves, to put in place certain programs that will help address certain issues, especially on the entrepreneurship side, on youth mobility as well, and as Seychelles is a small island, enabling exchanges between young people from Seychelles and other countries of the continent and also other parts of the world. I hope to help develop my country by using my background in communication and diplomacy, as Seychelles is a small country and an island. It is very necessary for us to be able to communicate effectively with other countries in the world. And I think diplomacy is one of those ways that this can be done, an active diplomacy. I would like to help the active diplomacy that the president has already been putting in place to help Seychelles be more connected to the other parts of the world. I have been in the United States for the past 5 weeks at Howard University, where I have worked, studied about effective management in public sector, how to effectively communicate with people in the work environment and also with the public who we are serving. And I have also learned how to use technology to enhance the natural talents that we have, and how to work with the diaspora, which is one of the treasures that Africa has to tap into. African leaders can harness the potential of more than 200 million young Africans by engaging them in more empowering activities. Young people should be seen as assets because of their creativity and their willingness to put their energy into creating new things that will help the majority, and use the experience of those who have come before us to help us tackle our various issues that are on the continent. So this engaging, empowering young people through activities where they can learn about their leadership skills, hone their leadership skills, but also employment and education as well. New leadership. We are very lucky in Seychelles to be on that path towards a knowledge-based society. So it takes vision, it takes creativity, it takes guts, and we are already on that path. I think the country needs leaders who are creative, who are visionary, and who can partner with other countries and multinational organizations. And those leaders will come from Seychelles, from the young people themselves, and using the experience of those who are already here to be able to better deal with the challenges of the country. If I had the chance to talk to President Obama, I would address the issue of small island developing states, as they are not always heard in this big concert of nations, and they are usually the countries that are most affected by the decisions of big countries, and environmentally, financially, economically. So I would like to know what can be done so that their voices can be heard.
That was Fatoumata Sylla of the Seychelles, one of hundreds of young leaders taking part in the Obama administration's Young African Leaders Initiative.
In early July, Cameroon's parliament passed a bill empowering President Paul Biya to ratify an interim partnership agreement with the European Union. The decision coincided with a July 10th consensus by 16 West African leaders approving agreements designed to create free trade areas between the EU, African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. Across the continent, however, the expanding acceptance of the agreements is stirring debate. Critics argue Africa is not prepared for competition from European goods, but backers insist the accords would enlarge market reach and earnings for African products. From Douala, Entarike Divine Jr. reports.
After a deadline on October 1, non-EPA countries will lose duty and quota-free access on their imports to Europe. Experts say the threat partly explains the reason for the increased approval of the agreements, as nations fear increased tariffs on their Europe-bound exports. Dr. Tabin Kongo is an international relations lecturer at the University of Boya.
If they are saying that it is going to benefit Africa, why is it that they should so much be pushing? The structures of the world economy, they have given the advanced industrial states the leeway to decide over all other countries.
In regions like Central Africa, where there are conflicting views on the EPAs, the EU has proposed country-specific hybrids called interim agreements. Cameroon signed one in 2009, enabling limitless untaxed exports to Europe, while gradually removing tariff barriers and opening up its markets for 80% imports from Europe between 2010 and 2015. Honorable Owonankono Joseph is a member of Cameroon's parliament.
When we signed the Cotonou Agreement in 2000, we agreed that we would move towards the conclusion of EPAs by 2007. Then this agreement was amended, so Cameroon signed in 2009. We have been benefiting our exports, banana, aluminium, timber, cocoa, tropical products, entered the EU duty-free, quota-free. And now, if we did not ratify them by 1st of October, then this particular situation will end.
Cameroon's unilateral signing of the provisionary EPA has attracted criticism from other countries in the sub-region. They say, as a member of the Economic Community of Central African States, Cameroon should have waited for the conclusion of a full sub-regional deal. But officials argue the decision was tactical for the middle-income country touted as the leading economy in the sub-region. Chad, the war-torn Central African Republic, Congo, Sao Tome and Principe, Equatorial Guinea, and the DR Congo are considered to be least developed countries and can continue exporting most products to Europe under the EU's generalized system of preferences and trade. However, officials say negotiations for a comprehensive deal for the region are ongoing. Meanwhile, critics warn the EPAs, no matter their form, risk eclipsing bilateral, intra-regional, and international trading alternatives. But Cameroon's Economy and Planning Minister Emmanuel Nganou Djoumessi insists the agreements allow modification and provide opportunities to drive industrialization and growth.
We are ratifying in order to continue selling our goods in this market without paying custom duties.
Minister Jumeci emphasizes that the EU is providing Cameroon $13 million to develop and improve basic infrastructure, including farm-to-market roads, improve the business climate, as well as boost the capacities of its productive sectors. But despite such justifications, the debate continues, with many speculating that President Paul Biya, who has been in power for 32 years, will ratify the agreements to please his European supporters and preserve his grip on power. For VOA News, I'm Tarike Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashard Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the convictions of human rights lawyer Tulani Maseko and magazine editor Beki Makubu for contempt of court in the Kingdom of Swaziland. Both men denied the charges, saying they were expressing opinions in the public interest and calling for the rule of law to be upheld. The men were detained in March after writing articles published in Mr. Makubu's magazine, The Nation, in which they raised concerns about judicial independence and integrity in Swaziland. Amnesty International reported that Makubu and Maseko were not arrested or tried in accordance with Swaziland's normal legal processes. Beki Makubu and Tulani Maseko have spent over 100 days in Sidwashini jail. Their convictions for contempt of court, for publishing an article critical of the High Court of Swaziland, and their ongoing detention, said U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf, appear to undermine respect for Swaziland's human rights obligations, particularly the right to freedom of expression. This right, she noted, is enshrined in Swaziland's own constitution and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The United States strongly supports the universal fundamental freedom of expression and urges the Swazi government to uphold the rights of Tulani Maseko and Beki Makubu to speak and report freely.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
The Voice of America, VOA.